Nightlife Science.
Yes, Matters Scientific. On these issues, we always go to our resident nightlife scientist, Charlie Lineweaver, who joins us again this evening. Charlie, good evening and welcome again to Nightlife.
Good evening, Earthling.
Well, on Earth here, there's lots of water, but there's not a lot elsewhere except that. Here, what about this? NASA has now confirmed there is water on the moon.
Yes.
Where is it? Why haven't we seen it before?
Well, here's the thing. You can just, there are about 100 different ways to discover water, and you may have seen, hey, we discover water on Mars and water on the moon. But the reason why this past week and is really important is because water has been found in, well, let me back up. We knew that the water was in these permanently shadowed regions. And because we've done some experiments and we've collided some things and we saw that. But what is new about this the new papers is someone has gone in with a telescope above this into the stratosphere, looked at areas of the moon that were lit by the sun, and near the poles of the moon, they have found H2O in a specific band called 6 microns. That's where they looked. And they found H2O, and it seems to be leaking out into the sunlit regions from the permanently shadowed regions. In other words, there's ice, lots and lots of ice in the permanently shadowed regions. We knew that. But it seems to be leaking out into the parts of the moon where it's not shadowed. And that was what was detected in this flying telescope. What was another interesting thing is, you know, I don't know if you go to when you buy liquor, there's a place where you walk into the fridge and get your beer cold. Well, on the moon, it's not minus 4 degrees, it's minus 200 degrees. So even if there were lots and lots of water in these permanently shadowed regions, these fridges are 10 kilometers, 100 kilometers big. So you have to get a robot or a machine to go into a region that's minus 200. That would be terrible. Hmm. But now what they found is that these fridges come in a whole variety of sizes, from hundreds of kilometers to 10 kilometers to 1 kilometer, even down to half a meter. So that's what's interesting, because then you can have a robot go up to this small permanently shadowed regions, reach in and get your beer or get your H2O, and then pull it out. And the whole time the robot will be at a comfortable, I don't know, 0 or 10 Celsius. And that's why this is such an important thing, because, hey, if you're an astronaut, you need two things: water to drink and rocket fuel, because you're the base. You're the base from which all kinds of new rockets will be launched by humanity to explore the solar system. And you don't want to have to get all that water from Earth. And if you can get it on, you know, you have to live off the land. That's what a good explorer does. And that's what astronauts, we think, we're more confident that they'll be able to do that because of these new discoveries.
Well, okay. Now, speaking of the moon, NASA selected Nokia to build a 4G network on the moon by 2022, really?
Yeah, doesn't that sound soon? Yes, they did.
But hang on, there's no one to make or receive calls.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if you've heard of the NASA Artemis program. It's very ambitious. They want to put, they say, boots on the moon by 2024. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe it'll be delayed by a year or two, but I don't think, even if Biden gets elected, it won't. I don't think he'll stop that. I think he'll probably support that too. And so sometime within this decade, without a fail, but maybe 2024, there'll be boots on the moon. And heck, when you're an astronaut walking around on the moon, you pull out your smartphone. You want to be able to talk to your other astronauts or mission control. And to do that, you need some type of wireless communication. And that's what we've been developing on Earth over the past decade or two. And so that's what they're going to put on the moon, 4G network. And when that happens, the astronauts will have 4G before half of the human population on Earth.
Yes. Oh, well, they can, they can play phone games on the moon.
Wait. They're going to mission control. Hey, we got a problem, Houston. This is just also important communication as well as entertainment, I guess.
The United Kingdom has lit up an unusual fusion reactor.
Yeah, you know, I don't. Are you aware? You've probably heard of nuclear reactors.
Yes.
And what that means is they're doing fission. They're taking things like uranium and plutonium, and that's like a fission. And that's the first atomic bombs were fission bombs. But the sun doesn't work with fission. The sun, this beautiful clean energy source, works with fusion. That means it takes hydrogen, pushes them together, and makes helium. And that's what humanity have been trying to do that for 50 years almost. And what this UK has just turned on a 55 million pound experimental facility to do fusion. It's a technology development thing, but it's still a big step forward. And I should mention that the international community is building even something bigger, but it won't be ready until 2025. But they hope and they expect that for the first time ever, humans will be able to get more energy out of fusion than they've had to put in. And the new technology in the UK that's turned on, they just made their plasma last week for the first time. Plasma just means they've ionized hydrogen and deuterium, and then they have a charged plasma. And those are the particles that zoom around this thing at very high speeds, and they're contained by a very, very strong magnetic field. So the whole thing takes a lot of energy to produce. The whole idea is to get more energy out when you do the fusion.
Okay. All right. So, yes, I know it's seen by many as the future,
it's
isn't
coming,
it?
By the way, Paul, if you're interested in ecology, this will be the lifesaver. This will get rid of all the CO2 we're making, and it will get rid of the nuclear devices that we have, the nuclear power plants, because those are fission and they're dirty. They produce all kinds of stuff that won't go away for millions of years.
All right, the blurry boundary between viruses and life gets even blurrier. That is, you know, are viruses alive or not? Well, it's been hard to say for a while, hasn't it? But viruses have now been shown to produce their own energy for the first time.
Yeah, this is, I'm really excited about this because, you know, I'm an astrobiologist and a lot of us are looking for life elsewhere. And when you look for something, you should know what it is. And we don't know whether viruses are alive or not because we say, oh, they can't self-reproduce. But they're a wonderful example of something that blurs the lines between life and, I don't know, a parasite of life. And about 20 years ago, the MIMI viruses were found, and they were really big viruses. They were bigger than some bacteria. But the new development, the new discovery, is that they've found viruses that have to maintain a electric potential across their membranes. And that's something that we are doing right now. But it also requires a metabolism to do that. They need an energy source. And that is something that they say, holy cow, viruses aren't alive because A, they can't self-reproduce, and B, they can't produce their own energy. They don't have a metabolism. These guys have some kind of metabolism, and that makes this line between life and viruses blurrier. Yeah. And I'm all happy about that because I think the whole thing was artificial in the first place anyway.
I think you're right. I think you're
but
right, exactly.
We need to know what life is, or we think we know, and then this is telling us we don't really know. Don't and know. I really enjoy it when we unlearn things like this.
Why do cabbages exist, Charlie?
Why do cabbages exist? Why do you think, Phil? Why do cabbages exist? This is a scientific question, right?
Yes. So, why do cabbages exist?
Well, the reason why this is a reasonable question is because if you look outside, you'll see green plants, and they have leaves that are green, and they're green because they have chloroplasts, and the chloroplasts are turning the photons from the sunlight, into energy. And that's what green leaves are for, right? But cabbages, they have all these leaves packed together in a really tight ball, and they're kind of white and only vaguely green. So what in the world are these white leaves doing? They're not doing anything for the cabbage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the question, why do cabbages exist, is kind of funny, because it shouldn't be there.
No.
But the simple short answer is it's there for us because we've domesticated cabbages.
Oh, is that right?
Have leaves that don't show up, that remain tender and young and whitish inside. And those are the best things to eat. As every bird knows, or every critter knows, it's best to get at the leaves when they just come out and they're young and tender. The same thing with cabbage leaves. They're young and tender and white inside, and we want it as much as possible. And so cabbages have been selected not to do anything for the cabbage, but to keep it like that. So
isn't that interesting?
Like a sacrificial lamb of a plant.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Well, it's the same with with all sorts of domestic animals, I suppose, too, isn't it? There are, and plants as well. Now, Denisovan DNA has been found in a cave on a Tibetan plateau outside of Siberia.
Yeah, so just to remind you, Denisovans are a group that's they're more closely related to Neanderthals than they are to us. And they were found about a decade or so ago in a cave, a Denisovan cave in Siberia. And these were interesting because they were so similar to Neanderthals, and Neanderthals are so similar to us. And there are many human groups that have Neanderthal and many human groups that have Denisovan DNA, and some human groups have all of them. Now, this was in the Tibetan Plateau, that means inside of current-day China. They, for the first time, found Denisovan DNA that wasn't associated with this small little cave that came as a gigantic surprise, but now we know they were widespread in ways that we haven't been able to trace yet, but it's they were much more widespread than we had evidence for before.
Wow, okay.
Denisovans were, you know, you could think of Denisovans kind of like Neanderthals. They were Neanderthals, and people, they were able to interbreed with people, and lots of people have Denisovan DNA as well as Neanderthal. You and I don't think we have Denisovan, but we have Neanderthal DNA.
We would have Neanderthal, yeah, exactly. All right, and just finally, Charlie, it's a great time to view Mars.
Yes, have you seen Mars lately?
I haven't.
Do you take walks at night at all, Phil? I guess no, you're in the radio studio.
No, I'm in this radio studio. That's right.
Well, for your viewers, if they can listen to you while they're walking outside, and if it's a clear night, one of the most beautiful sights this time of year is Mars. Mars is in opposition. It means that it's in the opposite position in the sky from the sun. When the sun is all the way down, Mars is all the way up. So Mars is very high in the sky. It's bright. Matter of fact, during October, a few weeks, it was brighter than Jupiter. And Mars is a tiny little thing, but it was so close to us that it was brighter than Jupiter. And it's just beautiful to see. And you can't miss it because it's kind of got a vague orangish color to it. And it's high in the sky.
Lovely. All right, Charlie. Always good to talk. Thank you.
All right, Earthling.
Yes, well, exactly. An Earthling quite content with his lot at the moment.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.